This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter, and Trump. Written and read by Dan Pfeiffer.
To Howley, who is simply the best. We know the battle ahead will be long, but always remember that no matter what obstacles stand in our way, nothing can stand in the way of the power of millions of voices calling for change. Barack Obama, Yes We Can speech, January 8, 2008. Introduction. If you're listening to this, it's too late. My final visit to the White House during the Obama era was not at all what I imagined it to be. Over the years, I had often thought about the moment when this chapter in my life, in the country's history, would come to a close. I imagined it to be bittersweet, but more sweet than bitter. I imagined it to be the triumphant end to a great era in American history, one that would be talked about with the reverence reserved for the great presidents. This was the last day of the Obama presidency, but I wasn't headed back for a raucous goodbye party or even a sheet cake in the Roosevelt Room to pat ourselves on the back for years of good work. We weren't celebrating at all. We were about 36 hours from Barack Obama, our first African-American president, leaving, and Donald J. Trump, racist reality TV star, assuming the presidency. Sure, I had thought about the possibility that Obama would be replaced by a Republican. It wasn't just possible, but historically probable. But I had never imagined something like this. Donald Trump in the White House was worse than my worst nightmare. To make this visit even more surreal, I was back at the White House to interview President Obama for a podcast, a medium I barely knew existed when I first met him back in 2007. I walked into the West Wing this one last time with my Pod Save America co-hosts, Jon Favreau, Tommy Vietor, and John Lovett, all of whom had been with me on day one of the Obama presidency. As is well known by all friends of the pod, Tommy and Favreau were original Obama campaign staffers, while Lovett worked for Hillary in 08. We forgave him, but never stopped making fun of him. There's something powerful about walking through the doors of the White House, even if you do it every day for 6 years. But this time felt even more consequential. This was the last time I would walk into a White House staffed by friends and colleagues, people with whom I had shed blood, sweat, and tears in the service of making hope and change a reality. This was the last time I would walk into a White House where Barack Obama was president. This might be the last time I ever walked into the White House, period. The place that had been my home for almost my entire 30s, the place where I had experienced tremendous triumph and tragedy, the place where I had met and fallen in love with my wife. You will meet her later. She's awesome. I'm proud to say I never took working in the White House for granted. But up until this moment, it had never occurred to me that I might never again walk through those doors. We arrived just in time for Obama's final press conference as president. This felt fitting. I hate press conferences. Sure, presidents taking questions from reporters is an important part of the democratic process, but I hate everything about them. I hate the process of preparing for them. I hate the questions that are asked, and I hate watching them. When I worked in the White House, I couldn't bear to be in the room when they happened. They made me too anxious, and I would watch in my office. I told people I did that so I could consume the press conference like the public, see how it played on TV. That was bullshit. I just wanted the ability to yell at the TV like a crazy basement-dwelling C-SPAN viewer, or the 45th President of the United States. On this day, I ostensibly had to watch in preparation for our pod interview, which would immediately follow the press conference. Even though I had no skin in this game, I was freaked out for the whole press conference, unable to sit still and yelling at the TV when I thought the questions were inane or the answers too long. A fitting end to my role in Barack Obama's dance with the White House press corps. I was mostly anxious about the interview. It was going to be his final interview as President of the United States, and this was a big deal for Pod Save America, which had just relaunched less than 2 weeks earlier. Interviewing a president is hard. I have seen experienced, world-famous journalists melt the moment they walk into the Oval Office. We weren't experienced, and we certainly weren't journalists. Our familiarity with the subject added to my anxiety. I know all too well how busy a president is, even on his or her last day in office. During my years working with Obama, one of the things I brought to the table was a finely honed sense of the exact moment when Barack Obama was tired of doing the thing he was doing. In staff meetings and prep sessions, I could always tell when Obama's brain had started to move on to the next item of his never-ending to-do list. It was often my role to bring the meeting or interview to an end before the length of the meeting exceeded Obama's patience. I dreaded the idea of seeing that switch flipped before we were done. The last thing I wanted to do was be yet another annoying thing on his schedule. I had been the one to ask the president if he would do it, so I felt particularly tied to its success. Or failure. We'd been working on questions for weeks. Obama is by his very nature a storyteller, so I went looking for the perfect anecdote to set him up to put the Obama era in perspective and explain how and why we ended up with someone like Donald Trump as president. When I left the White House in 2015, President Obama gave me a collection of photos from our time together, dating back to the early days of the campaign, as a farewell gift. Obama also gave me, a rabid Georgetown University basketball fan, a basketball autographed by Georgetown legends Patrick Ewing, Alonzo Mourning, and Dikembe Mutombo. One of the first photos in the book is from an early 2007 campaign trip to New Hampshire. Neither Obama nor I have any gray hair, and we both look so young. We are smiling and laughing, blissfully unaware of all that is to come, as we head into one of the endless series of meet and greets with voters that define the early days of presidential campaigns. Each photo in the album is attached to a different moment in the Obama era. The good times and the bad, the funny and the sad, our successes and failures. I never found the magic question for the interview, but I did find the seeds of this book. Listener beware. First, let's talk about what this book isn't. It's not a history of the Obama years, because I'm not a historian. It's not the inside account of the moments that will fill the history books, because that's Barack Obama's story to tell. And he will tell it much better. And finally, it's not a tell-all filled with gossipy scoops about the Obama White House, because I'm not an asshole. Instead, Yes We Still Can is a look back at my experiences on the Obama campaigns and in the White House to try to better understand the current state of politics and look at where we go from here. Much like Pod Save America, it's a no-bullshit conversation about politics in the era of Obama, Trump, and Twitter. As I was doing my deep dive through the Obama years, I kept finding examples of Barack Obama trying to navigate the very forces that created an environment where someone like Donald Trump could be elected. For 8 years, Barack Obama dealt with a dystopic, anything-goes media environment upended by the emergence of the internet, an intellectually bankrupt and increasingly rabid Republican Party, a right-wing propaganda machine embodied by Fox News, the rising tide of fake news and conspiracy theories, the emergence of social media platforms such as Twitter that rewarded the loudest voices and penalized thoughtfulness and analysis. It became clear to me in those dark days after the election that embedded in the successes and failures of our battles against these forces were lessons about how Democrats can ultimately defeat Trumpism. This account is my best recollection of what happened and what people said. I didn't take notes or keep a diary because at the time I had no intention of writing a book. But I like to think I have a good memory. I threw in some of my favorite fun stories just 'cause. Finally, this book is also an argument to young people that politics is something very much worth engaging in. It's fun, fulfilling, and really damn important. We need another generation of young people to get in the game. Barack Obama inspired a generation of young people to believe in the value of being part of something larger than themselves. As the rapidly emerging gray hairs of myself and my former 2008 colleagues show, that generation is now older. It's time for a new generation to step up and take charge of our future. I started writing this book in the days after that final presidential encounter with Obama. I didn't know what I was writing when I started. I just knew I wanted to say something about how we got to this moment in politics and how we could get past it. I was worried it would be a depressing exercise, the equivalent of wallowing at home looking at photos of an ex after a bad breakup. But it wasn't. Not at all. Quite the opposite, actually. I was inspired by something Obama said in the Pod Save America interview. Toward the end of the interview, Jon Favreau asked Obama,
Mr. President, you've talked a lot about we're all trying to get our paragraph right in history.
Yeah.
What do you hope that paragraph says about you?
When I think about what will most gratify me, it'll be if 20 years from now I can look back and I can say, well, look at all these people who first got involved, maybe even when they were too young to vote, in government, politics, issues, nonprofits, public service. And that wave just kind of, that cleansing wave washes over the country. And if that happens, then the details of how we dealt with climate change or whether the individual responsibility mandate on the Affordable Care Act was the right approach or not, that becomes less important. Because, you know, if we're getting the broad direction right, this is a pretty ingenious country. They're full of ingenious people. And we'll figure it out. And that's what I want, is I want everybody to feel like we can figure this out. If we just don't waste a lot of time doing dumb stuff.
The idea of Trump and his coterie of internet trolls, self-dealing Wall Street tycoons, and unrepentant racists wandering the halls of the White House doing dumb, mean shit is hard to stomach. Not a day has gone by since the 2016 election when I haven't been angry about the result and sad for the country. My hope in writing this book is to show that it doesn't have to be this way, that if we learn the right lessons, and most important, people, especially young people, get involved in politics, we can ensure that Donald Trump is an aberration, a speed bump on the path to the America we all hoped for in 2008. But it's up to us. Yes, we still can. Chapter 1. Started from the bottom. I don't believe in fate, but if I did, I would say it was fate that I ended up meeting Barack Obama at the exact moment when I most needed to meet someone like Barack Obama. Since I don't believe in fate, I will chalk it up to being one lucky SOB. I walked into my first meeting with Barack Obama in early 2007 with a good deal of skepticism. Ostensibly, I was there for him to interview me for a potential presidential campaign, but I wanted to see if Barack Obama the man matched up to Barack Obama the hype. I was pretty skeptical that a rookie politician espousing a gauzy but vague message of hope and change had what it took to survive the brutal freak show of presidential politics. Frankly, on paper, it was insane that he was considering running for president, but that's why I was there. I went into that meeting with a hard-earned cynicism from a decade in Democratic politics filled with defeats, disappointments, and a growing disillusionment. I was on the verge of quitting politics and trying my hand at something new. I had even started studying for the GRE and was looking at applying to grad schools. Instead, I walked out of that meeting with a new job and a new reason to hope. The rest is history, but I had almost missed it. This is embarrassing to admit now, but when the rest of the world was falling in love with Barack Obama in 2004, I wasn't paying any attention to him. In fact, I didn't even watch the famous 2004 convention speech that skyrocketed Barack Obama into national politics. I didn't watch it in the days after, when it was the talk of everyone in politics. And I didn't watch it in the ensuing 2 years when I was working in the Senate and seeing Obama on the weird Senate subway, which takes senators and their aides from their office buildings to the Senate chamber. It's really a short walk, but senators apparently need public transportation to get to votes on time, like the worst ride at Disneyland. In 2004, I was working day and night on Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle's re-election campaign in South Dakota. And due to the obsessive tunnel vision that campaigns give you, I was paying very little attention to anything that wasn't in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader newspaper. When Dreams of My Father, Obama's memoir, was re-released to rave reviews in 2004, I didn't read it. When The Audacity of Hope, Obama's instant bestseller of a follow-up book, was published, I didn't read it. The first time I heard the name Barack Obama, I was sitting in the back seat of an SUV driving around rural South Dakota with my boss, Senator Daschle. Senator John Corzine of New Jersey, who was heading up the Senate Democrats Campaign Committee, called Daschle to check in. After the call, I asked Daschle what Corzine had wanted, and he said, "John has just met the most impressive candidate who's running in the Illinois primary. His name is Barack Hussein Obama." Daschle went on to convey Corzine's assessment of Obama's immense charisma, smarts, and oratorical skills, as well as Obama's unique background. "Sounds amazing. Too bad he has no shot," I responded. Who am I? Why am I here? In other words, why the fuck should you care? My first encounter in politics was one befitting a Democrat. I got my ass kicked. It was 1988, I was in the 7th grade, and it was in Tokyo. My family was living in Japan because my dad worked for DuPont and had been assigned to a 4-year stint in the Tokyo office. I was attending the appropriately named American school in Japan, being that it was an American school that was most certainly in Japan. A few weeks before the election, my civics teacher opened up the class with an announcement. A Japanese television network was doing a special on the American election, and as part of their programming, they wanted to put on a mock presidential debate with two students playing the roles of then-Vice President George H.W. Bush and Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. The debate would be carried in part on local Japanese television. The teacher asked for volunteers and said the class would vote to choose the debaters. "Who wants to volunteer to be Vice President Bush?" About 10 hands went up. "Who wants to be Michael Dukakis?" One hand went up. Mine. I'm not exactly sure why I volunteered. Maybe I thought being on TV would be cool. It's not. I did enjoy debating, or as my mom would call it, being a smart aleck. She's too southern and proper to say ass. There's a famous story in my family about a 7-year-old me finding out that Santa wasn't real and turning it into a debate about the existence of God. I stand by my view then that if Santa, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy, all magical entities never seen by people, were fake, I was right to ask the question. My mom disagreed. Either way, I definitely did not think it through before I raised my hand. But now I was Michael Dukakis for the whole world, or at least the whole of Japan, to see. My parents were lifelong Democrats whose views had been shaped growing up in the South during the heyday of the Civil Rights Movement and going to college in 1968 when activism against the Vietnam War swept the nation. We talked about politics and world events at the dinner table, in part because my dad's job allowed us to see a lot of the world outside the United States. Prior to living in Japan, we had also spent 3 years in São Paulo, Brazil. My parents had ingrained in my younger brother and me the idea that Democrats were right and Republicans were wrong. Still, and always true. At this point, I had a very simple understanding of our two-party system. Republicans liked war and hated poor people. Also, still and mostly true, Democrats hated war and liked poor people. I also knew that Democrats did not win elections very often. As for Dukakis himself, he was a mystery other than the fact that he was a Democrat, was losing, and once looked ridiculous riding in a tank. I leapt into preparation. I did know a lot about life, but I knew enough to be aware that embarrassing yourself on TV was something you don't quickly live down in the cutthroat world of middle school. And beyond my own social standing, I hated losing in anything and everything. When I was about 10 or 11, my family got the board game Trivial Pursuit, and we would all play it together. Other than being able to answer some of the sports questions and some of the easiest questions on subjects like history that I had studied in school, I was completely flummoxed. The questions were about books, movies, television shows, and events that happened long before I was born. I was bad at the game, and I hated constantly losing. I took matters into my own hands. When my parents weren't looking, I would take the cards with the questions from the box and go into my room and memorize the answers. I would read each card several times, repeating the answers to myself before moving on to the next card. I did this almost every day for weeks until the next family game night, which went something like this. What Byzantine city was renamed Istanbul after being captured by the Ottoman Empire? Constantinople. And so it went. I answered the next 10 questions or so without getting one wrong, including one about what movie won the Best Picture Oscar in 1944 and won the game in record time. My parents couldn't tell if I was a remarkable genius or an inveterate cheater. By the end of the game, they were either sending me to juvie or early enrolling me in Yale. P.S. It's not that hard. The answer is Casablanca, the only movie that old that anyone has heard of. I stand by the idea that this was in no way cheating. My dad disagrees. He's wrong. But it definitely revealed my combination of nerdiness, obsessive compulsion, and competitiveness, which would define much of my adult life and help push me toward a career in politics. This was the level of preparation that I brought to my role of Michael Dukakis. Because I lived in Japan and the internet wasn't yet invented, the only way to learn about Dukakis was to go to an actual library and look at old newspapers and magazines. I printed reams of articles and made flashcards of the candidates' positions. My dad would quiz me at the dinner table about the finer points of Dukakis' policy papers. Heading into the debate, I was very confident. The role of Bush was being played by one of the smartest girls in our class, but I was sure there was no way she knew more or was better prepared for the debate. I could memorize an entire set of Trivial Pursuit cards. I was right. I knew more about the issues and positions of both candidates. And in what should be an object lesson for generations of Democrats, I still got killed. While I was trying to explain how Dukakis' plans were better for the middle class, my opponent was hammering me over the head, claiming Dukakis was soft on crime, soft on Russia, and wanted to raise people's taxes. I pushed back on these accusations with facts about Dukakis' plans, but I was on the defensive for much of the debate. It didn't matter that her points wouldn't have passed the scrutiny of a fact checker, or that I was right on the facts. Her message was much more compelling than my policy details. This is a lesson that I would need to relearn many times in my career. After we'd finished, our civics class held a mock election based on what they'd seen in the debate. I lost by a margin not dissimilar to the ass-kicking that the real Dukakis received in the real election. A couple of years after my less-than-stellar performance, my family moved back to Delaware so that I could go to high school in the United States. When it came time to think about college, I didn't really know where I wanted to go to school. All I knew was that I wanted to get out of Delaware. After living in Tokyo, life in the second smallest state in the Union, one best known for being the home of tax-free shopping, had started to feel suffocating. I ended up at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I was pleasantly surprised when I was accepted. I wasn't great about turning in my homework on time, so my high school GPA was a little below their standards. Before the beginning of my freshman year, I went to an event for incoming students hosted by a local alumnus to introduce us to our new classmates and learn more about the school. When I introduced myself to the host, he said, "Dan Pfeiffer, I remember your application." "Oh," I responded. "I have been serving on the acceptance committee for many years, and I have never seen a report on an alumni interview like yours. It's why you got in." Part of the application process involved an in-person interview with a local alumnus. These are usually scheduled for 45 minutes or so. Mine lasted almost 2 hours. My bullshit abilities were at peak performance this day. We talked about everything. Politics, the Gulf War, civil disobedience, the novel Catch-22, and what I learned about the world from living abroad. Everything I had ever read, experienced, and memorized came in handy that day. I didn't think much about it at the time, but it was now clear that I may have just conned my way into college. I was immediately scared shitless that people would figure it out as soon as I stepped on campus. This was the kick in the ass I needed. After gliding through high school doing just enough to do fine, I arrived at college with a chip on my shoulder to prove that I belonged and a strong desire not to flunk out. Don't get me wrong, I had a lot of fun in college, but I never skipped a single class in 4 years, no matter how tired, sick, or hungover I was. I dragged myself to class. I couldn't control how smart I was or how hard the classes were, but I could give myself the best chance to succeed by being the guy who went to class every day. After my freshman year, I never had a class before 11 or on a Friday. This was the same approach I'd taken in my decidedly mediocre high school basketball career. When I was growing up, all I wanted in life was to be a great basketball player, to star for my high school team, go on to play in college, followed by a career in the game, coaching, scouting, or commenting. Even at a young age, I knew that was as far as it was going to go. There are a certain set of physical attributes that are necessary to be a good basketball player. Quickness, leaping ability, long arms, quick reflexes, and of course, height. I was 6 feet tall in seventh grade and thought I was on my way to being 6'5 or so, but I never grew another inch. I had almost none of them. I was slow and couldn't jump particularly high. I tried everything I could to improve. I jump rope for hours in the driveway and worked out wearing those platform shoes featured in the back of Sports Illustrated that promised to make you able to dunk. None of it mattered. I realized pretty quickly that the only way I was going to make my high school team, let alone have any success at any level, was to work harder and care more than anyone else. I spent every waking moment either playing basketball, watching basketball, or reading about basketball. For a while, I slept with a basketball in my bed in the hope that somehow that extra bonding time would make me shoot better. I would record college and NBA games so that I could watch them repeatedly and break down what the players and coaches were doing. I ran shooting drills in my driveway long after the sun went down, with my poor younger brother being forced to rebound for me. I had an encyclopedic knowledge of which park, gym, or YMCA had pickup basketball games on which day. I was going to will myself into a basketball player if it was the last thing I did. I did make my varsity team and eked out a decent few years of ball, which might have gone better if I hadn't busted up my knee in my sophomore year. I tore my ACL in a drill trying to take a charge and then refused to see the trainer and tried to finish practice on it until my coach sat me down because my knee was the size of a grapefruit. In typically obsessive fashion, I rushed my rehab and came back too soon, never regaining what very limited bounce I had in my legs. After the last game of my senior year, my coach, with whom I had had an up-and-down relationship, said some perfunctory words about the seniors who were graduating. When it was my turn, the coach said, "Dan, I have never known a player who has made more out of less." Most of the team took, and perhaps my coach intended, the statement as a slight. Not me. I took it as a compliment. I had earned whatever limited success I had achieved by working for it, and I was going to do the same thing at Georgetown. Despite my less-than-stellar high school performance and the inadvertent caution of that alumnus, I ended up graduating with honors. As it turns out, the ability to memorize an entire set of Trivial Pursuit cards and being pretty good at bullshit, combined with perfect attendance, is the exact combo of skills needed to succeed in a liberal arts college with more than a touch of grade inflation. Being in the nation's capital and the alma mater of Bill Clinton, among many other political luminaries, Georgetown was a magnet for wannabe politicians. There were so many kids who were prepping 24/7 to one day walk the corridors of power. There was student government, college Democrats and Republicans, mock debate, Model UN, and 1,000 other students for or against this or that groups. I did none of those things. Instead, I preferred hanging out with my friends, getting drunk at Georgetown bars like the Tombs, and playing pickup basketball during every free moment. In 2010, the Georgetown College Democrats named me their Alumnus of the Year. Had to tell them that I had never been a member. As the prospect of graduation and being forced into the real world loomed, I realized that it was time to start thinking about what came next. Throughout college, I had assumed I would eventually go to law school. I don't really know why I assumed that, other than it seemed like what I was supposed to do. Since I hadn't taken a real science or math class since high school, medical and business school seemed to be a bridge too far. But before I signed up for more school, I wanted to spend at least a couple years out in the real world. Again, I don't really know why I wanted to do that, other than it seemed like what I was supposed to do. In my junior year at Georgetown University, I met a guy named Chad Griffin. Chad would go on to be the president of the Human Rights Campaign and lead the fight for marriage equality. He was a year ahead of me in school, but a few years older. He was moving into the famously pink row house we rented on Prospect Street right off campus. We needed a seventh guy to move into our group house so we could afford the rent, and he needed a place to live. Chad was from rural Arkansas and had been a student at Wachita Baptist University in Arkansas when Bill Clinton decided to run. Chad interned for Dede Meyers, who was press secretary on that campaign and eventually in the Clinton White House. Chad was good at his job and got offered a full-time position on the campaign. When Clinton won, he went to the White House as a staffer at age 19, and among other things, he got to see the world helping shepherd the media around during Bill Clinton's travels. After a couple of years in the White House, Chad came to Georgetown to finish his college degree. Interesting historical footnote. Chad's desk in the White House was the one that my wife, Hallie Pfeiffer, would sit at 20 years later. Chad had great stories about working on the Clinton campaign and in the White House, and it occurred to me that maybe working on a presidential campaign, and maybe in the White House, could be a good way station on the path to law school. Certainly better than being a paralegal in some law firm while taking practice LSATs on my lunch break. Not to mention, since my new caucus debate, politics had become one of the subjects I followed with Trivial Pursuit-like intensity. Old plan. Go to law school, become a lawyer, probably hate my life. New plan. Go work in a presidential campaign, work in the White House, go to law school, become a lawyer, hate my life, but have done and seen some cool things first. I had enough credits to graduate a semester early. Instead of venturing out into the real world, I took the first semester of my senior year off, and Chad helped me land an internship in the White House in Vice President Al Gore's office. This was fortuitous timing, aided by Chad pulling a few strings for me, since Gore was going to be running for president in a couple of years. Any internship, even one in the White House, boils down to copying, filing, and getting coffee for the people who get coffee for other people. Mine was no different. None of it is rocket science, and there's no real way to distinguish yourself from other interns as long as you show up on time and don't still smell like the previous night's party. For the first couple of weeks, I was assigned to do the clips, which in that day meant actually cutting articles out of the newspaper, gluing them to pieces of paper, and then copying them for the staff. Then I caught a break. At that time, the White House was being investigated by the Republicans in Congress for potential violations of campaign finance law during the 1996 campaign. Amazingly, they were accused of selling access to the Lincoln bedroom and raising money from Buddhist monks. These things were sort of true, but not illegal. We definitely need new laws. Gore was specifically implicated, and therefore his office was forced to produce reams of documents to investigators, schedules, memos, phone messages, etc. Basically anything that had anything to do with fundraising of any sort. This was a massive undertaking, and I was sent to help the counsel's office with this task. I worked on the top floor of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next to the White House, out of a windowless room that was stacked floor to ceiling with binders full of documents. White House, intern, is a very broad term. Each page of documents was assigned a number, something like B865, so they could be tracked and filed appropriately. I was constantly copying, filing, and refiling these documents and became very familiar with them. Gore was being investigated by several congressional committees, the FBI, and every reporter on the planet. Every reporter and Republican wanted to muddy up the likely Democratic nominee. Every day, the office would get a request for some set of documents. Even with the tracking numbers, finding the requested memo or email was very time intensive. Early in my tenure, one of the attorneys in the counsel's office came in and asked for a very specific memo about a very specific fundraising event that was under scrutiny. "I need this by the end of the day," he said, and turned to go. "Wait, this will take just a minute," I said, and walked over to the shelf, grabbed a binder, and opened it to a certain page. "Is this the one you're looking for?" He looked at me like I had a third arm growing out of my head. "How did you know where that was?" I have copied and filed these things so many times that I remember the numbers. Word got around to the lawyers, researchers, and communication staff who needed quick access to the documents that I was the intern to ask. In hindsight, I was treated a little bit like Rain Man for this Parlor trick, but at the time I loved it. The same weird ability to memorize Trivial Pursuit questions happened to be something in great demand at this exact moment in the White House. I was offered a job, but demurred because I wanted to finish school. Instead, my internship was extended to a second semester. I was nothing more than a paper jockey, but I was a valued one. After college, I got an offer to work in the press office of a division of the Department of Justice, biding my time for what I assumed was a guaranteed job on the Gore campaign. Losing sucks, and other stories from the campaign trail. When Al Gore announced his candidacy for president, I didn't get a job. When he did his second wave of hiring, I didn't get a job. When he fired half his staff and hired new ones, I didn't get a job. I got so worried that I wasn't going to get hired that I started looking for other campaign jobs. I had my boss at the Justice Department, who had worked closely with Hillary Clinton in the White House, send my resume to her Senate campaign. No response. In Joe Bluth fashion, I thought I had made a huge mistake. After Gore won the primary, I finally got the call from Chris Lehane, who was Gore's campaign press secretary and my boss when I was an intern. Chris told me to move to Nashville, where Gore's campaign was headquartered, and he would get me a job in the press office. I was ecstatic. I quickly signed a temporary lease on an apartment in Nashville, packed up my car, and prepared to make the trek. One problem. Chris went dark on me and wasn't returning my calls or emails. I assumed this was because he was busy trying to win an election. The day I was supposed to get in the car and start driving, I woke up, finished packing, and logged onto the internet to check the news before hitting the road. After patiently waiting for the internet to dial up, which was a thing that used to happen, I checked the NBA scores from the night before and then started skimming the major papers to see the latest campaign news when something caught my eye. Crap. Lehane had gotten into a dispute with Gore's campaign manager and taken a temporary leave from the campaign with speculation that he would never return. The person who had promised me a job was on the outs. I had a decision to make. Should I delay my trip and wait for things to shake out with Lehane? I had paid a security deposit on the apartment and had no other options, so I said, "What the hell?" and drove to Nashville and hoped Lehane had told someone about me. He hadn't. On my first morning in Tennessee, I drove to the campaign headquarters. I sat in my car in the parking lot for a good 20 minutes, trying to get up the courage to go inside. This had the potential to be quite embarrassing. Finally, I walked in and approached the woman sitting at the reception desk. "Hi, my name is Dan Pfeiffer. Chris Lehane told me to come here for a job." She looked at me with a blank stare for a minute and then asked, "How do you spell Lehane?" I got the sense that this woman spent much of her day dealing with crazy people who wandered into the office of the potential next president. On this day, I was just another crazy person. I knew I was in trouble. No one knew who I was, why I was there, or that I had been promised a job. I was eventually passed off to the volunteer coordinator, who gave me two choices: go back home or suck up my pride and join the kids and retirees who were volunteering on the campaign. I was assigned to answer the phones in the press office with a very uninterested teenager who was there as part of a high school civics project, and a very nice man in his late 70s who had volunteered on every presidential campaign since Adlai Stevenson, but was in the wrong job since he was very hard of hearing and couldn't pronounce the names of the callers. It was pure chaos in the tiny broom closet masquerading as an office where we worked. The phone was ringing off the hook, messages weren't getting to the right people, and calls weren't getting returned. On my second day, I took matters into my own hands and implemented a system for answering the phone, distributing messages, and tracking who got called back when. This caught the attention of some of the campaign aides. Within a few weeks, I was offered a job working with the regional media. One big caveat in the job offer: they couldn't afford to pay me for my work for another 4 months or so until after the convention, when the campaign would get an infusion of federal campaign funding. Thus began a lifelong habit of making terrible financial decisions in the service of a career in politics. Within days, I knew I had found my calling. The campaign headquarters buzzed with excitement at all hours of the day and night. Every decision felt massively consequential. My fellow campaign staff were young, energetic, and very smart. Campaigns are meritocracies of sorts. Sure, some people get their job based on how much money their parents gave to the party or because they went to school with the candidate's kids. But once you're in the door, no one gives a shit who you know, where you went to school, or even how old you are. Things are just moving so fast that no one has time to worry about those things, Hard work and smarts get rewarded with opportunities to move up to a bigger, better job with more responsibilities. All of my new colleagues had real experience working in the White House, on Capitol Hill, or on other political campaigns. Most were at least a few years older than I was. I had done none of the above. Despite my new duties, an actual desk with an actual phone, I felt like a glorified volunteer. But I knew the drill. I had to prove myself by working harder and hopefully smarter than those around me. I tried to be one of the first people in and one of the last people out of the office every day. Over time, I proved that I belonged and was treated as a real member of the team, despite being someone who had wandered in off the street and still was, at best, a glorified volunteer. Now, of course, some shenanigans in Florida and some bad campaign strategy decisions meant my position on the Gore campaign didn't end in the White House job I had hoped for. My first campaign came to an end in an airport bar as I watched Al Gore concede the election to Bush while some drunks booed Gore. I was on my way to move back into my parents' house. I was unemployed, broke, and had nowhere else to go. I lasted less than a week at my parents' house before I headed back to D.C. to sleep on the couches of friends and look for a job. This was a tough time to be an unemployed Democrat. Thousands of us had just lost our jobs and were about to compete over a very small number of positions in Democratic politics. After playing a very small role helping elect Democratic governors in New Jersey and Virginia while working at the Democratic Governors Association, I got a call from Steve Hildebrand, who had been a top aide to Al Gore, asking if I had any interest in coming to work for him. I didn't know Hildy, as he was called, but his reputation as one of the best political minds in the party preceded him, and working for him would be a great opportunity to learn and get a leg up on the next presidential election. "I'm looking to hire a communications director for a Senate race that I am managing," Hildy told me. "Interesting. Where's the race?" I asked. "South Dakota. I'm managing Senator Tim Johnson's reelect." I tried to suppress a groan. South Dakota might have been the South Pole as far as I was concerned. I mean, I had never even really been to the Midwest. All I knew was that it was cold. Really, really cold. I underestimated how cold it was. Hildebrand made a compelling case about the importance of the race and the quality of the team he was putting together. I assumed that he had tried and failed to convince a long list of more prominent and experienced political operatives to move to South Dakota before he got to me. My initial thought was to turn down the job. But I wanted to run communications on a Senate race, and no one else was exactly beating down my door. Once again, I said to hell with it, put all my possessions in my car, and drove to South Dakota. I knew so little about South Dakota that I told people for weeks that I was moving to Sioux City, before I learned that Sioux City is in Iowa. Sioux Falls was where I was moving. South Dakota is a beautiful state filled with great people, but it is so cold that if you leave your car parked outside for too long, the engine freezes. Despite the cold and the geographic confusion, moving to South Dakota put me on the path to Barack Obama. It was just a very windy path. Being left at the altar. My cell phone rang on the morning after that election. It was a Washington, D.C. number. I figured it was some reporter doing a postmortem on Tim Johnson's victory by less than 0.1% of the vote. Our come-from-behind win shocked everyone and was the rare bright spot on a very dark night for Democrats. Within hours of the election being called, folks were saying we had run the best campaign in the country. "Hi, Dan. It's Tom Daschle." "Hello, sir," I responded to the Senate Majority Leader and the most powerful Democrat in the country, and the other senator from South Dakota. After congratulating me on the victory, Daschle cut to the chase. "Dan, I'm thinking seriously of running for the White House, and I know you're going to have some other opportunities, but I would appreciate it if you would wait until I make a decision before taking another job. If I do this, I want you on my team." I was blown away. This was a Senate Majority Leader calling me and asking me to join his team. How could I turn that down? "Absolutely, sir. I'm flattered you would ask," I responded too quickly and eagerly to be seen as playing it cool. The week before Thanksgiving, I was summoned to the Capitol by Pete Rouse, Tom Daschle's top aide and a man so powerful that he was referred to as the 101st Senator. Pete was such a big deal that his staff had to build a secret back exit to his office in the Capitol so that he could come and go without being harassed by senators and lobbyists hanging around to bend his ear. Despite his powerful persona, Pete might be the nicest, most thoughtful person in politics. The Capitol was a ghost town because the Senate was out of session for the holiday. I met Pete in a Capitol coffee shop that was so empty I thought it was closed. I had worn a suit and tie for the meeting. Pete showed up in jeans and cowboy boots. After gruffly heckling me for being dressed like a kid at his confirmation, Pete laid it out for me. "Tom has basically decided to run. His wife is supportive. He wants to make a final decision over the holidays, but it's a done deal. Hildebrand is going to manage the campaign, and we want you to play a senior role in the communications team. There was no specific job, but senior role certainly seemed important. Before Pete could finish talking, I accepted. It wasn't until later that I realized that I had just signed up to move back to South Dakota, less than 3 months after returning to D.C. I spent the next 6 weeks on conference calls planning out the launch of the campaign. In the first week of January, we were in the final preparations for the announcement of Daschle's campaign for president. We had gone so far as to have the winter dance at Daschle's alma mater in Aberdeen, South Dakota, moved out of the gym so we could hold the announcement event there. On the morning that I was going to fly to South Dakota to prepare for the event, I got an email from a well-connected reporter asking me about a rumor that Daschle had changed his mind about running. I laughed. How could that be true, I thought. I would certainly know that if it was. I got in my car and started driving to the airport. My cell phone rang, and it was Steve Hildebrand, the man who was going to manage the campaign, calling to sheepishly tell me that, yes, the rumor was true, and that Tom had a last-minute change of heart and was going to stay in the Senate. 2 years later, I was still working for Daschle and eventually helped run his re-election campaign. It was a brutal, exhausting affair that ended with me being part of the group that had to tell Tom and his family we weren't going to pull it off. The memory of consoling his mother still haunts me. I missed the 2004 presidential race and instead had worked on the most high-profile losing campaign in recent memory. Couldn't have played my cards worse if I'd tried. Bye, bye. I was dark, fed up with politics, and thinking seriously about going to law school yet again. And then I got a fortuitous call that kept me out of the legal profession. This time it was Anita Dunn, an advisor to Indiana Senator Evan Bayh, whom I had worked with on the Daschle campaign. Evan was thinking of running for president in 2008 and was looking to hire a communications director to help him prepare for that potential campaign. I wasn't immediately sold on the idea of Bayh as presidential material, but I had just helped lead the first losing campaign for a Senate leader in 50 years, so I was mostly just glad someone wanted to hire me again. Bayh was a genuinely nice guy, and I needed to pay my rent, which made it easier to swallow some of my concerns about his political centrism. I had entered politics as a bleeding heart liberal. In my high school, one of the requirements for graduation was undertaking a month-long senior project. Some students wrote plays, others painted murals, and conducted sophisticated science projects. I wrote and defended a thesis that argued for socialism as a better governmental system than capitalism. I was young, dumb, and wrong. My liberal idealism had been dulled by the presiding political strategy of the Democratic Party of the late 90s and early 2000s. That the best way to win was to dull the edges of our liberalism and co-opt Republican issues to win over swing voters. It wasn't inspiring, and after defeats in the 2000, 2002, and 2004 elections, it was clear it wasn't effective either. I also felt that I had something more to prove in politics. I had just gotten my ass kicked. Daschle had run a great race, but his opponent had bested us when it counted. I had learned some lessons from the defeat and was eager to test them out in a new arena. After 2 years of plotting, planning, and many, many trips to small towns in Iowa, New Hampshire, to build the network for those two states to play such a critical role in the nominating process, the Bayh for President train was about to leave the station. Right about this time, Barack Obama popped up on my radar. Obama had been out campaigning for Democrats in the 2006 election and drawing huge crowds everywhere he went. There was a building grassroots Draft Obama movement on this new site called Facebook. From my perch, it all seemed ridiculous. What freshman senator would run for president? Obama agreed to speak at Iowa Senator Tom Harkin's annual steak fry. This event was a traditional proving ground for presidential candidates looking to make a name for themselves. My former boss, Steve Hildebrand, who had a lot of experience in Iowa, was staffing Obama on this trip. For all the people who make their living talking and writing about politics, this was a sure sign that Obama was going to run. I was still a skeptic. Obama had a book coming out, and floating a presidential campaign is a great way to sell a book. Ignore this admission if by the time you hear this book, I have floated myself as a potential candidate to juice up lagging sales. On his way home from the steak fry, Hildebrand called me on my cell phone. I quickly answered because I was desperate to hear his scouting report on Obama. Hildy, how was it? Hildebrand is a stoic of Norwegian descent. It takes a lot to get him excited, but he was talking a mile a minute. Obama is the real deal, the greatest, most inspiring politician of my lifetime. Pfeiffer, you have to come do this. Do what, I asked. Get Obama to the White House. Is he running? He better. We need him. It wasn't clear to me if we meant America or Hildy and me, since we were both still suffering from the emotional trauma of losing Daschle's race. After getting left at the campaign altar by Daschle, I was pretty skeptical about joining a campaign that did not yet exist. Fool me once, etc. Plus, after 2 years of working for him, I was loyal to Evan Bai. As the weeks went on, the momentum for an Obama run gained steam, and Hildebrand's entreaties to me grew more frequent and impassioned. Pete Rouse was now Obama's chief of staff and was making a similar case. I was starting to develop serious FOMO. I didn't know Obama, but he was impressive, and there was a palpable excitement around him beyond anything I had ever seen in politics. Plus, Obama was surrounding himself with some of my favorite people in politics. A week after Bai announced his presidential exploratory committee, we were scheduled to visit New Hampshire as part of our announcement tour. Then we got some bad news. Obama had just agreed to speak at a New Hampshire Democratic Party dinner and hold a book signing during our visit. This would, of course, lead to unpleasant comparisons about the size of our crowds and the enthusiasm for our candidacies. The press, and the public, was in a feeding frenzy of excitement over a potential Obama candidacy. We had already announced our trip, so canceling it was not an option. A story about Obama scaring us away was worse than one about his bigger crowds. I still doubted Obama would run, and the odds would be long, especially against the two frontrunners, Hillary Clinton and former vice presidential nominee John Edwards. So off we went to take our lumps. Turns out that when you make chicken salad out of chicken shit, it still tastes like shit. When I got to the gate at BWI Airport for the one nonstop flight to Manchester, New Hampshire, I saw more big-name reporters than one finds in the White House briefing room on a normal day. I noticed there was a crowd of reporters standing around someone or something. When I got closer, I saw that it was Robert Gibbs, Obama's communications director, who was holding an impromptu press conference of sorts, while Alyssa Mastromonaco, Obama's scheduler at the time, stood by watching with some amusement. I had never met Alyssa before, but Rouse had been raving about her to me. I didn't know it at the time, but Alyssa would become one of the most powerful people in Obama's White House and one of my best friends. I stood off to the side, trying not to be noticed, when a reporter from USA Today came up to me. "Dan, what are you doing here?" "I'm headed up to New Hampshire to staff my boss on his first official swing through the state." "I thought you worked for Bai." "I do. He's campaigning in New Hampshire this weekend." I had no idea," the reporter replied before going back to talk to Gibbs. It went downhill from there. On the final event of our trip, Bai was participating in a meet and greet at the home of a state legislator. Bai was on his game and impressed the crowd with his record of winning and governing in a red state. Maybe, I thought, there was an opportunity here to be the electable alternative to Clinton and Obama. As we were leaving, we asked one of the hosts of our event for directions back to the airport. He responded, "Normally I would tell you to hop on the highway, but given the traffic for the Obama event downtown, I would suggest taking back roads." 2 weeks later, I was on a conference call with Bai and his top advisors debating whether he should drop out of the race and stay in the Senate. It was clear that he had already decided to leave the campaign. At one point, Bai had to take another call, and I used that break to walk out in the hall and leave an urgent message for Pete Rouse. "Pete, it's Pfeiffer. I don't know whether Senator Obama is going to run, but I would love to have a serious conversation with you as soon as possible." Pete returned my call later that night after Bai dropped out. We scheduled a coffee for the next week. And in what I felt was a real warning sign, the meeting was going to be in the exact same coffee shop where I had accepted the position on the never-to-be Daschle presidential campaign. Pete and I sat down, and in one of the more surreal experiences of my life, he gave me the exact same pitch from 4 years prior. "Obama is almost certainly going to run. His wife is on board. He's going to make a final decision over the holidays, but it's a done deal." The thought bubble over my head said, "Are you fucking kidding me?" I was excited about the opportunity, but based on my recent disappointments, I was trying to keep my expectations in check. I just knew deep down that Obama wasn't going to run. Around that time, I got a call from John Edwards, the incredibly ambitious former senator who had been John Kerry's choice to be VP in 2004. Even if Obama ran, most political prognosticators thought that Edwards had the best chance to beat Hillary Clinton, who had been planning for this race for a decade and was certain to run. After a quick perfunctory interview with Edwards, he offered me the position of communications director. I spent the holidays catching up on the Obama thing, reading Obama's two books, watching his interviews and some of his speeches, including the 2004 convention speech, which I hadn't seen, and starting to fall into platonic political love. I was still torn between my head and my heart. I had been beaten down in recent years by some really painful campaign losses. The Democratic Party felt stale and uninspiring, and being out of power in Washington during the Bush years made everything I did feel futile. Even the campaigns I had won had felt like moving the pieces around the board without winning the game, instead of being part of something bigger. I had almost quit politics twice in the last 2 years, seriously explored a job at a nonprofit, and studied for the LSAT and the GRE. I had experienced professional success in the sense that I had gotten some, quote, good jobs, and had built what I believe was a decent reputation among my colleagues. When, quote, good jobs came open, I often got a call. But if I was honest with myself, I had been in politics for a decade, and what had I accomplished? What difference had I made? Whether it was from watching The West Wing on a loop or reading every book written about Robert Kennedy's 1968 campaign, I had an unrequited relationship with politics. I desperately wanted to experience a politics that felt more like a cause than a campaign. I had never felt anything resembling what I imagined that historic Kennedy campaign felt like, and I was dying to know what that was like. I could point to playing a role in this fight or that fight that had helped prevent some harm being done to people by the Bush administration. That's sort of like feeling good about a couple defensive plays in a game you lost by 3 touchdowns. I wanted to be part of something that mattered to the world, something that actually helped people. There's a quote from the HBO show The Sopranos that I kept coming back to in this period. Discussing his discontent with the state of his career as a mob boss, Tony Soprano says, "It's good to be in something from the ground floor. I came too late for that, and I know. But lately I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end, the best is over. I was sick and tired of playing not to lose and losing anyway. There had to be something more." Game on. Right after New Year's, I got a call from Obama's office asking to schedule a meeting with the senator. This could mean only one thing. He was in the race. On the morning of the interview, I woke up feeling a little nauseous. At first I thought I had a touch of the flu coming on, but then I realized it was just nerves. This was a big deal for me. This might be my last chance to be part of something special. Something different from everything I'd done before. My first clue that Obama was cut from a different cloth was that he didn't send some eager beaver aide to fetch me for our meeting. At 11 a.m. on the dot, Obama walked out into the lobby with no jacket and his sleeves rolled up, introduced himself as Barack, which is pretty funny in hindsight, and shook my hand. I'd had hundreds of meetings with politicians, and never before had the elected official personally come to grab me for the meeting. This may seem like a small thing, and it is, but it told me that Obama's huge celebrity had not gone to his head. A group of mostly African-American school kids on a field trip from Illinois were sitting in the lobby waiting for a junior aide to give them a tour. They looked slack-jawed at Obama. They didn't react to him like a senator. Most kids couldn't give a shit who their senator is. But these kids were staring at Obama like a hero. It was clear that this African-American man potentially becoming president meant something very powerful to them. Obama excused himself from me to go over and talk to the kids, none of whom could vote in the upcoming presidential primary contests. This was before the age of selfies, but Obama took photos with each of the kids. This wasn't a perfunctory photo op. Obama did something very rare for a politician. He listened to them. "This guy is either very good or very good at faking it," I thought to myself. Obama sat me down on the couch in his surprisingly small and very dimly lit office. As a freshman senator low on the seniority list, he had one of the worst offices on Capitol Hill. Obama started the interview by telling me that in a few weeks he would announce he was running for president. He didn't hedge in any way or give himself an out. Obama didn't know me or have any reason to trust me with this information. I had done this awkward dance with soon-to-be candidates on a couple of prior occasions. The entire conversations were conducted in a way to ensure plausible deniability. "If I were to run, how would you approach the campaign that I have not yet decided to launch?" The politician knew what they were saying was BS, and they knew that I knew what they were saying was BS, but we all had to play our assigned role in an absurd play. Obama didn't seem to have the time or patience for this sort of game. I took this as another positive sign. Over the next 45 minutes, Obama talked to me about why he wanted to run for president, what he wanted to do as president, and why he was not going to heed the advice of the old Washington hands who were telling him to wait. Not once in the conversation did Obama mention poll numbers, campaign strategy, or political tactics. He didn't try to convince me why he would win or how his campaign was the best path to a plush White House job. Obama made the case that the campaign was worth running because he had something to say that he felt was worth saying. At the end of the conversation, Obama looked me in the eye and asked, "How often do you get to put your shoulder against the wheel of history and push?" I was in. I walked out of Obama's office after the interview having accepted a job on the spot. The position that the Obama campaign offered me was traveling press secretary. This job meant that I would travel everywhere with Senator Obama and potentially be on the road nearly nonstop for 2 years. This was not my first choice job, but the two other jobs I wanted, communications director and national press secretary, were filled. So it was this job or no job, and I wasn't missing this opportunity. I had no idea what I was going to get paid. I am notoriously bad at asking this question, which is awkward in any employment context, but particularly in politics, but the whole point is that the cause is more important than the compensation. Yet, this was a critical piece of information considering that I had a mortgage in D.C. and was about to pick up a rent bill in Chicago. I didn't find out that answer until Robert Gibbs sent me and Bill Burton, another early hire, the first draft of the Communications Department budget. Exactly 2 weeks after my interview slash immediate job acceptance, I gathered with my new coworkers in a conference room at a downtown D.C. law firm for the first official strategy meeting of Obama for America. As we waited for the candidate to arrive, we went around and introduced ourselves to one another and made small talk. In addition to Hildebrand and Rouse, who had recruited me to this effort, seated around the very large wooden table were David Plouffe, a nearly 40-year-old Delawarean and college dropout who was going to manage the campaign. Plouffe had cut his teeth working in the Iowa presidential caucus and had a reputation for being a numbers whiz, incredibly disciplined, and tough as nails. Plouffe was also a bit of an enigma. When he detailed the tragic death of his dog in his memoir of the 2008 campaign, even his closest confidants on the campaign were taken by surprise. We had no idea his dog had died. In fact, we didn't even know he had a dog. David Axelrod. Axe was Obama's longest-serving political advisor and one of the best-known and well-respected political consultants in the party. Unlike most of his colleagues in the mercenary-like profession, Axe had never lost his soul in the pursuit of power or money. He was the rare true believer in politics, and his idealism would fuel our campaign. In addition to his strategic acumen, Axe was equally well-known for being a bit of a mess. He once famously broke his BlackBerry by getting donut glaze in the trackball, and in the White House on the back of his office door hung dozens of neckties that had not survived his breakfast. Alyssa Mastromonaco. One secret about politics is that the most important person on the campaign is the director of scheduling in advance. On the Obama campaign, Alyssa was that person. She combined a huge, warm, uproariously funny personality with the ability to work miracles on any and all matters. Alyssa was a huge fan of the Grateful Dead, knew every episode of Beverly Hills 90210 by heart, as I did, and treated her staff and colleagues like family. Alyssa would become one of my closest friends and would literally save my life in the years to come. Robert Gibbs and Bill Burton. Gibbs, Burton, and I at this point made up the entire Obama National Communications team. Future Pod Save America co-host Tommy Vietor was already on his way to Iowa to help lead our efforts in the must-win Iowa caucus. Gibbs, a former college soccer player from Alabama with a long career working on Democratic campaigns, was one of Obama's closest political advisors. With a sharp tongue and a penchant for Southern aphorisms, like busier than a one-legged man in a butt-kicking contest. Burton, like me, was new to Obama world and had just come off a very successful stint helping the Democrats win back Congress. He was super sharp, but also known for getting on your computer when you weren't looking and sending joke emails to others on the staff. Jon Favreau. I was surprised by the presence of the 25-year-old speechwriter in a strategy meeting like this, but I quickly learned two things. One, Obama, who considered himself a writer who entered politics as opposed to a politician who writes, had a unique relationship with his speechwriters. Two, Favreau was a supremely talented political strategist with a knack for knowing the exact right argument to make and the way to make it. He would soon become very famous as a Wunderkind presidential aide and not the guy who directed Iron Man. Eventually, Barack Obama arrived and walked around the table and greeted each of us. As he took the one remaining empty seat at the very crowded table, he declared, "All right, folks, let's get to work." Chapter 2. How Not to Lose a Campaign. In my career, I had worked on a presidential campaign, a gubernatorial campaign, two Senate campaigns, and a ballot initiative. I thought I had seen it all, or at least most of it. But what awaited me in Chicago was like no campaign I had ever seen. This was not a typical Democratic campaign. I know this because it didn't do the thing Democratic campaigns typically do. Lose. I didn't fully grasp what was so different about it until years later. In a dreary meeting room in a nondescript hotel in San Jose in 2013, President Barack Obama was meeting with some of the most important players in Silicon Valley. Around the table were founders and executives from the most important tech companies in the world. These were titans of industry meeting with the leader of the free world. It should have been riveting, but somehow it wasn't. The conversation was focused on reforms to federal government information technology procurement rules. Not exactly the stuff West Wing episodes are made of. This meeting, like so many others, was a response to the catastrophic failure of healthcare.gov, the website where people were supposed to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. When the fate of your signature domestic policy accomplishment depends on a website, and the website doesn't work, it's time to pay a visit to Silicon Valley. I was backbenching, which is a White House term for staff who were in meetings with the president but didn't make the cut for the table, and I was buried in my BlackBerry catching up on endless emails. Being at the table is great, but if you need an opportunity to get work done, sit backbench. Some of my most productive hours in the White House were in National Economic Council policy discussions. Apologies to the econ team. My addiction to my phone will be a running theme in this book, as it is in my marriage. At one point, one of the attendees told the president that we needed to bring a startup mentality to government. I perked up because I knew this would get